Genesis chapter 37. Genesis chapter 37. We spent last week really beginning what's going to take us through the rest of the book of Genesis with the life of Joseph. And in seeing Joseph at the age of 17, he has two dreams in particular, both of which of his dreams show that he will be elevated above his own family, his brothers, even in one of the dreams, his own father. And yet in understanding this, his brothers do not see that as anything wonderful. Instead, not only do they hate him, they even learn to hate him even more. And in hating him even more, they even become jealous of him. And, of course, here's Jacob's partiality. And any time partiality gets introduced into a situation, it always expels peace. Whether it be in a family, whether it be in a workplace, whether it be in a community or a nation, when you start to see partiality be glorified, you're going to destroy. Jesus even talked about it. A divided house, a divided kingdom. He says it's always going to fall. And so, yet you understand there can be times where he can overcome. He can always overcome that. But to realize someone to walk by faith. So, here it is. His brothers hate him. And all of a sudden, this idea comes up real quickly, verse 12. It says, then his brothers went to pasture their father's flock in Shechem. And remember, Shechem's about 50 miles north. Come, and I will send you to them. And he said to him, I will go. Then he said to him, go now and see about the welfare of your brothers and the welfare of the flock and bring word back to me. So he sent him from the valley of Hebron, and he came to Shechem. So there's 50 miles in between these two places. And in doing this, I'm sure in their minds, they were not thinking, this is the last conversation we're going to have for 22 years. And perhaps in the mind of Israel or Jacob, to think that might be the last conversation he would have with his son, based upon what he perceives, what's about to transpire. And so often those things happen in our lives where we have a final conversation with somebody. We don't realize it at the time. And of course, we know it's not going to be the final conversation. But here they are, verse 15. So Joseph heads out north, gets about 50 miles away to Shechem. He says, a man found him, and behold, he was wandering in a field. And the man asked him, what are you looking for? He said, I'm looking for my brothers. Please tell me where they are pasturing the flock. Then the man said, they have moved from here, for I heard them say, let us go to Dothan. So Joseph went after his brothers and found them in Dothan. So he travels an additional 15 miles. So here Joseph is 65 miles away from home, the valley of Hebron. And he gets all the way up here just to check on his brothers. I mean, think about it. His father sends him out just to check on his brothers about the flock. And notice the dedication that Joseph has. He doesn't go, I've already traveled 50 miles. That's plenty. He runs into a random person who says, oh, I think I've seen those people. And your brothers have gone up to Dothan. And to go, well, there's another 15 miles away from home. Yet, see the dedication that's in Joseph. He's been sent with a task. And so what does he do? He reaches its completion, even if it gets more difficult. And so he finds them at Dothan, verse 18. When they saw him, talking about his brother seeing Joseph, and this conversation from verses 18 through 22 is a conversation that his brothers have before Joseph ever reaches them. They see him coming, and they have this kind of conversation. It says, when they saw him from a distance, and before he came close to them, they plotted against him to put him to death. How far is this hatred and jealousy gone? Way too far. Notice the way that it's talked about here, it says they plotted against him to put him to death. They're not just saying, what do you think about putting him to death? They're saying, how are we going to put him to death? And neither one of those conversations are good. But to realize how deep the hate and the jealousy go, that just in the fact that they see him, They're 65 miles away from home, the Valley of Hebron. And as soon as they see him on the horizon, they start talking among themselves. How could we kill him? Now, how did they get there? And what are they considering so much that would take them to this kind of pit of evil? Notice what they're working on, verse 19. They said to one another, here comes this dreamer. Why do they hate him so much? Because of his dreams? Have you ever had somebody tell you a dream they had, even if you were in it, and thought, I want to kill you because of your dream? I mean, doesn't that just sound ludicrous in our mind? Yet it tells you the way they saw Joseph. They knew he was favored, which didn't help the situation. They hated Joseph, even though Jacob's really the problem in that, right? And so you look at how they're starting to reason through things. And as we mentioned last week, in the book of Genesis, Joseph is the most Christ-foreshadowed character in the book in terms of bringing salvation and deliverance for a people. I'm not saying Joseph is perfect. Don't take that thought. But realize, how many times can you think of where people plotted to kill Jesus in the gospel accounts? If you actually take the time to go through them and count them, you'll come up with 8 different times where the people wanted and plotted to kill Jesus before they actually crucified him. Now, I'll go through these real quickly. But in the gospel accounts, in Luke chapter 4, Jesus comes to his own hometown in Nazareth, and he quotes from Isaiah 61 when he's reading in the synagogue. I mean, to think, this is happening during worship. And he talks about that the favorable year of the Lord is here, that the Spirit's been poured out upon me to preach to the poor. And afterward, they take him out to the brow of the hill of the city because they want to kill him. In Matthew, Mark, and Luke, it mentions a story about Jesus speaks against the Pharisees' tradition of how they want to celebrate the Sabbath. And at the end of Jesus making these statements, they want to kill him. They start plotting to kill him. Whenever Jesus in John chapter 5 talks about God's authority is greater, the word of God is greater authority than their traditions, what do they want to do with him then? They want to kill him. Then, John chapter 8, Jesus calls himself the I Am. And they pick up stones and they want to kill him. And then John chapter 9 starts off with a story about another man who's going to be healed. And the disciples are asking questions while they're on the run, which is something. John chapter 10, Jesus referred to himself as being God. And they wanted to kill him. They plotted to kill him. John chapter 11, after Jesus raises Lazarus from the dead, and all of a sudden people are starting to believe because of Lazarus, what do the people want to do now? Not only do they want to kill Jesus, now they want to kill even Lazarus too. Who would have thought that being raised by Jesus would put a target on your back? What does that tell you about these people? Then, another mention in terms of Mark and Luke, whenever Jesus cleanses the temple the second time, by whose authority are you doing these things? Of course, Jesus turns around and says, well, I'll ask you a question. John the Baptist, is he from heaven or is he from men? He from God or from men? And they don't want to answer the question because they don't want to get into the politics of if we say what we really think, the people aren't going to like us anymore. And you go, oh, but what do they decide? They start making plans. They want to plot together to kill Jesus. Then, of course, another time when Jesus tells the chief priests in Matthew 21, Mark 12, and Luke 20, when Jesus tells the chief priests and the Pharisees that the kingdom of God is going to be taken away from them and given to another people, they understood the parable. And they decided, we're going to kill him. We've had enough. A lot of times we think about Jesus being loved. We need to understand that Jesus was also hated. But why was he hated? Because he told the truth. He didn't make anything up. Why is Joseph hated? He's telling them the truth. I had these dreams. He doesn't say, and this is how it'll be. He just says, these are the dreams. And they hate him for it. As soon as they see him on the horizon, let's plot to kill him. Then, back here in Genesis 37, look at how this comes even more. Verse 20. Now then, this is the continuation of their statement. Here comes this dreamer. Now then, come and let us kill him and throw him into one of the pits. And we will say a wild beast devoured him. Then let us see what will become of his dreams. Now, not only are they planning on how to kill him, what else are they planning? Here's how we're going to cover it up. Now, here's a little note in life. If you already know it, what does this tell you about their conscience? They have a conscience that's not good enough to stop them from thinking along these lines until here in a little bit because of somebody speaks up. But yet, there's enough of a conscience to know, do they know what they're doing is wrong? Because why would you cover it up if you didn't think it was wrong? Right? So here they are, and in the New Testament, this is going to be referred to as an evil conscience. An evil conscience. One that is justifying evil, and yet still trying to cover it up and cover it over. And I want you to see how that changes, just real quickly. Go over to the New Testament. Look at the book of Hebrews. Look at Hebrews chapter 10. Just want to look at two passages real quick. Hebrews chapter 10. Look down at verse 22. It's talking about having a great high priest who stands in the true tabernacle. Verse 22, he says, let us draw near with a sincere heart and full assurance of faith, having our hearts sprinkled clean from an evil conscience and our bodies washed with pure water. And the imagery here, of course, is about baptism. And noticing, here's the aspect of when the blood of Christ is sprinkled upon our hearts. Is whenever we're baptized into Christ. And he says, we draw near in full assurance of faith because you understand what God has promised. And he says, and having our hearts sprinkled clean from an evil conscience. So where does the evil conscience work? Within the heart. And so here it is within the heart, which is where you do your thinking, where motives are really drawn out of. He says, you have an evil conscience before you come to Christ. Then he brings up this thought. He says, a heart sprinkled, he says, sprinkled clean from an evil conscience. Now, seeing this picture, I want you to see another view of baptism that ties also together with conscience. Look over at 1 Peter chapter 3. Look at verse 21. 1 Peter chapter 3, verse 21. He's just talked about how the ark separated Noah and his family, the eight of them, from everyone else on planet Earth in the ark, that they would be spared. They found salvation. Verse 21, during the flood, of course. Corresponding to that, baptism now saves you, not the removal of dirt from the flesh, but an appeal to God for a good conscience. He says, through the resurrection of Jesus Christ. So notice how these two passages work together in tandem. In Hebrews 10, it's talking about to have our hearts sprinkled clean from an evil conscience. That the evil conscience would be removed and taken out of the heart. And then what's it going to be replaced with? A good conscience. Now, notice here in verse 21, he says, baptism now saves you, not the removal of dirt from the flesh. It's not about just a physical bath. It's well beyond that. He says it's an appeal to God. Usually, when do we use the term appeal? A courtroom setting, right? If you're found guilty in a lower court, what can you do? You can make an appeal to a higher court. What does law do? What did law do to all the Jews? What did it convict them of? Sin. And the wages of sin is death. So on the lower court of law, you're condemned. Unless you can do it perfectly, flawlessly, like Jesus did. Lower court says you're guilty. What do you want to do? I want an appeal. What's this appeal going to be based upon? Because you can't just say, I don't like the lower court's ruling. I just want to try this again. What do you have to have? You have to have something new to offer, right? New evidence, new situation. Let's complete the idea here. He says, an appeal to God for a good conscience through the resurrection of Jesus Christ. In baptism, who are we being united with? Jesus. And what's our appeal based upon? Jesus' resurrection. And based upon his resurrection, paying for my sin, what can I now have before God? A good conscience. I always find it amazing. I always love having this conversation any chance I get. When someone has been baptized into Christ, about a week later, I love to ask them, does the world seem like a different place? If they've really come to this out of faith, the answer is the same every time. They go, it's like I'm walking in a whole new place. Because you know what that evil conscience isn't doing anymore? It's not trying to justify evil. As if to say, it's okay for me to hate my brothers because he has these arrogant dreams. They're not really arrogant though, are they? Because dad loves him more, it's okay for us to want to kill him. See how this evil conscience works? You see why it's detrimental to us? Then all of a sudden you come into Jesus and you fail and you have an advocate before the Father. What do? I can confess my sin. I can agree with God that what I did was wrong. And what will Jesus do? Or what will God do through Jesus? He's faithful and righteous to forgive us, right? Because now there's a good conscience. This is working upon righteousness. Be careful whenever you try to justify evil. Because that's not working off of the good conscience. Sometimes it works off of ignorance. But at the same time of seeing this picture, if we're trying to cover something up, we're already making a wrong move. Right? Now, come back to Genesis chapter 37. So here they are. They say, come, let us kill him and throw him into one of the pits. And we will say a wild beast devoured him. Already making up the plan for deception. It says, then let us see what will become of his dreams. Then, verse 21. But Reuben heard this and rescued him out of their hands and said, let us not take his life. Now, here's Reuben, who is the oldest, but Reuben doesn't have the greatest track record. I mean, if you remember in chapter 36, he had actually committed adultery with his stepmom. And you go, oh, this is so terrible. And what he does with Bilhah back in Genesis 35, excuse me. And so, yet in all of that, at this point in time, he's the one who's speaking something good. Which tells you, don't be surprised. Sometimes God uses people you may not think he could use. But here he is. He says, you know, let's not do this. Let's not take his life. Let's not kill him. Then, of course, Reuben goes on further to say, verse 22, shed no blood. Throw him into this pit that is in the wilderness, but do not lay hands on him, that he might rescue him out of their hands to restore him to his father. What does Reuben want to have happen in this situation? He doesn't want Joseph to die. He says, just throw him in the pit. And Reuben's going, and when you guys get away from here and you're taking care of the flocks, he says, I'm going to draw him out and I'm going to take him 65 miles back home to where Dad is. Now, here's Reuben. He may have made a terrible decision with Bilhah, but he's the one who's thinking seemingly the most clearly at this point in this group, other than Joseph. Then, verse 23. So it came about when Joseph reached his brothers. Notice what finally happens. He gets there. All this conversation in verses 18 through 22 was before Joseph ever actually got to where they were. They went through the thoughts of, let's kill him. Here's how we're going to cover it up. I throw him in a pit. We'll say he devoured by a wild beast. Reuben says, hey, let's not do that. Let's not kill him. He says, just throw him in the pit and I'll rescue him later. Then Joseph actually reaches his brothers and notice right off the bat in verse 23, he says that they stripped Joseph of his tunic, the very colder tunic that was on him, and they took him and threw him into the pit. Now the pit was empty without any water in it. So how do they respond? So quickly. To strip him of his cloak, to throw him in a pit, there's no water in it, so it's dry. And if you stop and really think about it for a moment, and later on, we're not going to read it right now, but later on in Genesis, it's going to talk about this specific moment. And they're going to bring it up and they're going to say, we saw the distress of his soul, and we did nothing about it. The guilt that they're about to incur from this point through the next 22 years of their life is still going to be hanging like a dark cloud over them because they didn't do anything. And whenever your conscience functions enough for you to know that you should cover it up, that means your conscience is going to wear you out. It is not going to let you forget that what you did. Now, here they are. And as soon as Joseph gets there, you just imagine your own brothers stripping you of your tunic, throwing you into an empty pit. You can't get out on your own. It seems to be that deep. And you're going, how in the world am I going to take a report back to my dad? Verse 25. Then they sat down to eat a meal. How are they feeling about everything? Hey, let's eat. Which tells you how bad it is. They're not going, hey, we should rethink what we're doing here. We're being a little too much. Then, while they're sitting there, it says, and as they raised their eyes and looked, behold, a caravan of Ishmaelites was coming from Gilead with their camels bearing aromatic gum and balm and myrrh, on their way to bring them down to Egypt. They look up and they see these, and notice here it talks about in terms of Ishmaelites, and understand there's a connection to them with Ishmael. Remember about Ishmael and Isaac being brothers, and now here they are, Jacob is their father, Isaac is their grandfather. So these people are not distant relatives in the Ishmaelites. And here they are carrying around spices and things on their way down to Egypt. And if you think about these spices that they're taking with them, things that you probably think later on about, does myrrh have anything in terms of the life of Jesus? Can you think of any instances where it shows up? What are they? All right. Whenever he's given the gift by the Magi, they bring myrrh. And when else? Whenever he's buried, if you remember, they bring myrrh to put upon his body. A fragrant scent. Actually, it's a very pungent scent to overcome the smell of death. But you think, okay, we see those in the life of Jesus, just as a side note. Then it talks about the balm. You ever sang a song, There is a Balm in Gilead? Do you know that this is one of the three verses in the Old Testament that actually bring it out? The other two are in Jeremiah. But the idea here, he says, here they are. They're bringing these things. They're on their way down to Egypt. Verse 26, Judah speaks up. And just look at his heart. Judah said to his brothers, what profit is it for us to kill our brother and cover up his blood? Now, just as an introductory statement, he says, what's really the payoff for this? And at this point in time, if you didn't know the next verse already, you go, oh, good, finally, somebody's going to speak some sense. But he sure doesn't. He says, you know what? There's no benefit for us to do this, to kill our brother and cover up his blood. Verse 27, come and let us sell him to the Ishmaelites and not lay our hands on him, for he is our brother, our own flesh. And his brothers listened to him. He goes, you know what? We get nothing out of this just killing him. How about we sell him? We'll sell him as a slave. We'd hate to be the ones that actually killed him. Man, do you see how this evil conscience thing works? Anybody thinking clearly here in this story? I mean, Reuben's the closest. And if you notice here, it's Judah, whose name means praise to God. Now, I'm not saying that's what he's doing, but you start to notice these things. He says, and his brothers go, you know, you got a point. Let's not kill him. We can make some money off of this. Now it's not just hatred and jealousy. Now it is greed. This thing's getting worse. Then, verse 28. Then some Midianite traders passed by. Now, Midianites and Ishmaelites are not one and the same. Do you remember who the Midianites descend from? It's also tied to Abraham. Most people don't remember Abraham's third wife. She's the one that kind of gets left out in our memories a lot of times. Her name is Keturah. You can read about it earlier on in Genesis. And in seeing this, there's Hagar, Sarah, and Keturah. Keturah has six sons. Midian is one of her sons. So the descendants are the Midianites. So realize, these are also people who are related to these 12 sons of Jacob. So some Midianite riders or traders passed by. So they pulled him up and lifted Joseph out of the pit. Think about that, lifting your brother out of the pit. And yet for Joseph, this is one of those moments. You just imagine. Here your brothers have stripped you, thrown you in a pit. I don't know whether he can hear them talking or not. If he can, that'd be really scary. Then all of a sudden you're being lifted out. You kind of have a bag of emotions, right? Are they lifting me out because everything's good now? They're lifting me out now because they're about to kill me? Are they lifting me out because of some other option, like selling me? I mean, you ever have moments like that in your life? Well, there's a lot of options, and not very many of them are good. And what do you have to do? You have to trust the Lord. Now, later on, Joseph is going to see this crystal clear. But in this moment, I don't know that he knows anything about what's coming, other than what he's dreamed about. Now, notice how it continues. They lifted Joseph out of the pit and sold him to the Ishmaelites. Didn't sell him to the Midianites, sold him to the Ishmaelites. When the Midianites are coming by, that's when they lift him out. Then they sell him to the Ishmaelites for 20 shekels of silver. Now, assuming that 10 brothers are there, the Benjamin's not there, and there's 10 of them. I mean, for 2 shekels, you'd sell your brother. This is not a whole lot of money. Now, 20 shekels of silver. Then notice how it continues. He says, thus they brought Joseph into Egypt. So here's Joseph. Now he's traveling with the Ishmaelites, and he's on his way down to Egypt as a slave, not as a pleasure seeker. Talk about uncertainty. Then, verse 29. Notice how this continues on. Now, Reuben, remember what Reuben wanted to do? Remember what his brothers were wanting to do when Reuben spoke up? Now, Reuben returned to the pit, and behold, Joseph was not in the pit. So he tore his garments. What is Reuben assuming? Because what was the plot whenever Reuben was saying, let's not kill him? And notice this next statement. Verse 30. He returned to his brothers and said, the boy is not. Now notice there is in italics. And I want you to think about reading this without that word. because I think it really makes it a little bit more clearly. The boy is not. And he's 17 years old. Still calling him a boy. The boy is not. As for me, where am I to go? How does it feel whenever you're trying to put together a plan to deliver somebody and it doesn't work? How do you feel? Do you feel guilty? Sometimes you wish you'd have done more. Maybe I should have done more than just talk about not killing him. Maybe I should have made a bigger stand. Which should tell us something. When we have the opportunity to do good, don't wait. Don't wait. Here's what he sees. And of course, he gets the rest of the story. He says, where should I go? Verse 31. So they took Joseph's tunic and slaughtered a male goat and dipped the tunic in the blood. And sure enough, they really care about this tunic. None of them wanted it, did they? What they were all jealous about, now do they want? Nope. He says to kill a male goat. And I want you to know, a male goat has a lot of blood. And they dipped this coat in the blood, verse 32. And they sent the very colored tunic and brought it to their father and said, we found this. Please examine it to see whether it is your son's tunic or not. I want you to see how deception works. I think you can see right through this, of course, because you already know the truth. Do they say, your son's dead? No. Do they say, we sold him off? No. They say, look at this tunic. Is this your son's tunic? And that's what deception does. And this is the way an evil conscience works. I didn't lie. I didn't tell anybody a lie. I just led them to think something that's not true. What's your word for that? Deception. Falsehood. Falsehood covers a big range and spectrum, doesn't it? If you think about Ephesians chapter 4, it talks about, since we're putting on the new self, he says, lay aside falsehood. Speak the truth with one another, for we are members of one another. And you go, you notice through this scenario, what's really not being talked about? They're not willing to say, we hate Joseph. We're glad he's gone. They say, oh, look, a tunic. Is this your son's tunic? Then notice how deeply seated this hatred is. He says, we found this. Please examine it to see whether it's your son's tunic or not. Verse 33. Then he examined it and said, it is my son's tunic. A wild beast has devoured him. Joseph has surely been torn to pieces. He draws his own assumption, doesn't he? And that's exactly what they wanted him to do. All of a sudden, they got their plan to work, they think. Then, notice verse 34. And I want you to see how hard-hearted they are. So Jacob tore his clothes and put sackcloth on his loins and mourned for his son many days. Jacob is grieving. And if you really consider this, I mean, it's no secret that Joseph is his favorite son. And remember, what was the last thing that Jacob told his son? Go bring me a report. How would you feel if you told one of your children to go run an errand for you and they died trying to honor what you wanted? Can you see Jacob's grief? Not only his favorite son, but he's doing something to honor his own father. Now, hoping that you can hear a little shadow of Jesus. Why does Jesus die? Who's he honoring? His Father. And because of honoring his Father, he's going to lay the path to save who? His people. Right? Joseph's going to lay the way to be the Savior, to deliver. Savior might be a strong term. To deliver his brothers and sisters and father. You see, Jesus, when he dies, isn't he going to deliver his brothers and his sisters? Remember Jesus' words? He says, those who do the will of my Father, these are my brothers and my sisters. He even says my mother. So there's a little bit of a parallel there. Then notice verse 35. It says, Joseph mourned for many days. It says, then all his sons and all his daughters, so Dinah wasn't the only daughter, arose to comfort him, but he refused to be comforted. What do they try to do? What hypocrites? It's because of what they've done that he's sorrowing like this. It's not because his son is dead. And then, out of their hypocrisy, they raise up to want to comfort their father because he's in distress. Ugh. Just the hypocrisy of it. And 1 Timothy 4:2 talks about the hypocrisy of liars. It's like a heart that's been seared, a conscience that's been seared with a branding iron. You think about how hard-hearted they are. Watch their father grieve, and they know exactly why, and their hatred and their jealousy don't let up. It doesn't even have any tenderness to go, don't you see what we're putting Dad through? Nobody. Nobody makes that move. Notice the words of Jacob. And he said, surely I will go down to Sheol in mourning for my son. So his father wept for him. And to watch your father cry over his son, who he thinks is dead, that is still alive. And to not be moved at all to say, we have sinned. We have failed. But just to soak up in the hatred and the bitterness and the jealousy and relish his tears. Putting on the hypocrite's face to try and comfort your father. You'll see why this guilt lingers for 22 years because of things that come up later in the book of Genesis. Now look at verse 36. He says, meanwhile, the Midianites sold him in Egypt to Potiphar, Pharaoh's officer, the captain of the bodyguard. So now you start to see where Joseph gets placed. In terms of Potiphar here, he says, Pharaoh, the captain of the bodyguard. In other words, the personal people who actually protect Pharaoh. And to think, what a place to be. And yet what Joseph's going to have to go through for the next many years. It's 22 years between here and whenever his brothers come back. It's 9 years back. So that gets you back to 13 years. He's going to go through 13 years of difficulties before he really starts to see what God's purpose is for him. And to realize sometimes we have to go through a lot of difficulties before we really see what God is raising us up to do in honoring Jesus in our lives. But you have to be faithful all the way through. You can't wait till the end. All right. Lord willing, next week, come back, chapter 38.